Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where T is for The Living Daylights, the 1987 James Bond film which introduced Timothy Dalton as 007. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we pop aboard the Ferris wheel to explore Dalton's Bond debut, he's neither playboy or tennis pro, he's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
We were supposed to have a special guest this week, but due to technical issues, he is no longer able to join us, but we will be using his notes, so thank you very much, Mark Harrison, doing a sterling job as always. But this episode will kick off a mammoth run of six film specials in a row. So we will have The Living Daylights, followed by The Man with the Golden Gun, The Spy Who Loved Me, The World Is Not Enough, Thunderball, Tomorrow Never Dies, to get us through the next 6 weeks. Hopefully we'll be able to stick to one a week. It's already proving more difficult than we thought. So don't be surprised if there are maybe a few changes to the schedule along the way. But let's kick things off, Brendan, with a quick chat about The Living Daylights and your experiences with it. Are you a big fan?
I am getting into it more and more. It's only recently I've started watching it because obviously the podcast, and watched it at the cinema in the summer. Before that, then I kind of ignored it. It's not one that really got screened on bank holidays on the TV. But every time I see it, there's a lot to appreciate, and I just think Timothy Dalton puts in a great performance as well.
He really does, yeah. And I think I'm the same. I think I sort of neglected it a little bit over the years, but it is one that I am enjoying more and more every time I see it. And especially when it was on the big screen over the summer, I just sort of, it really gelled for me. I always thought it was a little bit slow, but I think on the big screen, it really, really does work. And there's a lot of really great elements on it. And let's not forget, this is a really important film in the series. It's the last of the Cubby Broccoli films. License to Kill is the last of the Cubby Broccoli films, but it's getting to that era, isn't it? This feels like the last of the big ones, because it's John Barry's last time. Cubby's probably most hands-on final film, I would say, because he was sort of quite poorly on License to Kill, I think.
Yeah, and also it sticks to the Bond formula, whereas License to Kill doesn't. So this is like the last that feels like a
the last
classic.
Of the true classics. Yeah, indeed. So the synopsis for Living Daylights: armed with razor-sharp instincts, a gadget-laden Aston Martin, and his license to kill, Agent 007 must battle diabolical arms merchants who are united in a terrifying conspiracy for world domination that may be linked to the Soviet military high command. But let's kick things off, as we always do, talking about what the world of cinema was like in 1987.
Well, I'm just going to take you back to 1985 for a bit, because there's a bit of issues with the film licensing due to Turner Broadcasting. They wanted to buy MGM and United Artists, so this meant things became complicated. Ted Turner, he saw the value of MGM's film library, so he wanted to get hold of that. So he did. March 1986, the deal was finalised, $1.5 billion, and the company was renamed MGM Entertainment. But Ted Turner, he sold MGM's United Artists back to Kurt Corcoran for $480 million. And with Ted Turner unable to find the financing for the rest of the deals because the debt that he'd taken on all of his companies, August 26th, 1986, Ted Turner was forced to sell MGM's production and distribution assets to United Artists for $300 million. With the MGM studio lot and lab facilities sold as well in this. Now, why does this matter to Bond? Well, it's just more background shenanigans that we've seen throughout the story of the Bond franchise, and luckily it didn't affect this film too much. But Cubby, you know, he didn't like the way that these companies dealt with businesses like, you know, with the business like this, and didn't seem to have any care for the product they were actually making, you know, the films. And so 1987, it's the 25th anniversary for the franchise. So, yeah. You know, silver anniversary, a pretty big deal at the time. Lots of Bond everywhere, as we've had this year with the 60th. But it's crazy that it was only its 25-year anniversary at that point. It's
small fry, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. In terms of the Academy Awards, we had Sean Connery. So he'd won for Best Supporting Actor for his role in The Untouchables. So staying ever relevant. I mean, this was where Sean Connery was having a bit of his renaissance, wasn't he? He was really churning some good stuff out at this point. But in terms of the box office takings, any guesses for the top three?
Oh, 87. Oh, no.
Well, number three, we've got Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Okay, yeah.
Number two, we've got Fatal Attraction. And number one, I couldn't have guessed it if you'd have asked me, you know, to name 200 films. Three Men and a Baby. Made $167 million at the box office.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, I know. So that's the state of film and where the franchise is at. But obviously, with that, we had to find a new Bond.
Yeah, and I mean, this came 2 years after View to a Kill, and Roger Moore had made it quite clear that that was going to be his final Bond outing, and with probably for good reason. I think it was 57 at the time when he made that one, 58. And so he was ready to finally leave the series behind. And the hunt began for a new James Bond. Now, there were lots of different names that were thrown around at the time. I think MGM, the studio, were quite keen for Mel Gibson to be considered. Could you see Mel Gibson as Bond?
I don't think I could. He's too brash.
Yeah, possibly too short as well. So that was one. There was lots of other names though in the mix. There was this guy Finley Light, who always gets mentioned when you look at people casting for Living Daylights. Some other Australians, Anthony Hamilton and Andrew Clark. There was also the person that sort of was really mooted was also Sam Neill. He was a big favourite at the time for this show. He made Riley, Ace of Spies. But the man who came closest to it, and we covered this in great detail in our Pierce Brosnan episode, was Pierce Brosnan. He was in the frame to play Bond because of his popularity in what's the show called? Remington Steele.
Yeah.
And he got close to they basically got him to agree to do the job. He got as close as doing screen tests, and there's photos of him signing his contract at Pinewood with John Glenn. But because of his linking with Bond, basically it was leaked by a newspaper, the popularity of the show spiked. So although Remington Steele had been cancelled and looked like Pierce Brosnan was going to be able to take the role, the popularity of Remington Steele took a spike, and Remington Steel, the network behind it, renewed their option and brought Brosnan back to make some more of that show.
Yeah, annoyingly, and not many.
Not many.
Yeah.
Well, Cubby said that he couldn't have his Bond being on TV and in the movies at the same time. So basically, they had to cancel Pierce's Bond deal. He did come back for one series of Remington Steel, which tanked, and that was it. I think it was even just a few episodes, like extended length episodes, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, Brosnan was out of a job, unfortunately, so they had to... Bond had to move fast, and they had Living Daylights on the slate, ready to shoot. Casting director Debbie McWilliams at a recent event at the BFI, she said that she always has to have someone in her back pocket ready to move on. And Dalton was the man. But they'd spoken to Dalton before, right?
Yeah, 1969, I believe, wasn't it? For On Their Majesties. That early.
On Her Majesty's, yeah. That was, I think, his first brush, and he said he was too young at the time. And yeah. I think when you if you listen to the commentary for this film, John Glenn says the same thing. He was too young to be Bond in 1969. Mm. And he also thought, actually, Pierce Brosnan probably would have turned out to be too young as well in 1987. But yeah, I mean, Dalton was basically drafted in at the very last minute. He had to sort of get dropped into the movie straight away. I think they had to delay it slightly for him to finish shooting on Brenda Starr.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Dalton was the man to play Bond. Yeah, but you can see Sam Neill's screen test for it on the DVD. He does the From Russia with Love scene, as they always do. So, into pre-production then, director John Glenn returned to direct his fourth Bond film in a row, and he influenced the story directly by suggesting Gibraltar as a location for the opening title sequence. He'd recently been on holiday there, and he thought it was a really good idea to have as a setting for Bond, with it being, you know, a part of the British Isles that is out in the middle of nowhere, and he thought it was a good sort of location for it. It was also his idea to have Bond and Kara escaping in a cello case at one point. This idea was initially shot down by the production team, but the story goes that he borrowed a cello case from a rehearsing orchestra to demonstrate it to Cubby and Michael G. Wilson, who thought, actually, you know, it's not too crazy of an idea. And that's how we convinced them. And in terms of writing the script, there were early plans to set the film in China. That was somewhere they always wanted to shoot. There was talk of doing some stuff on the Great Wall of China, but it just proved to be too difficult logistically to shoot over there. The other version of the early version of the Living Daylights was a draft of the story, which was going to be a prequel with a young James Bond who was raised by his grandfather. He gets then his grandfather's friend recruits him into the Secret Service. I think his friend is M. And then Bond, this young Bond, gets teamed up with the older 007 to go on a mission. And obviously they go on the mission, they bond. Bond learns how to be a spy, and then 007 dies on the mission. So at the end, then Bond assumes the mantle of 007. This was vetoed by Cubby, Broccoli, the producer, who thought that audiences wouldn't want to see Bond as an amateur. But they did screen test a guy, a British actor called Mark Greenstreet, who was in his mid-20s, because he was quite popular at the time, in a series called Brett Farrar. But that was not to be. But it shows how far they went down that path by doing the screen test for it. So do you think you would have... A mid-20s Bond would have worked?
I think it's more likely to work next time rather than that earlier. I think they would have had... I mean, going from a 58-year-old, I think it's a big jump, a big ask.
Yeah. So the Living Daylights itself takes its name from an Ian Fleming short story published with Octopussy in 1966, and it deals with Bond on a mission to stop a KGB assassin from killing an agent. He's got to kill the assassin before the assassin kills the other agent. And so this sort of story takes place over three nights, during which Bond falls in love with a cellist, who then turns out to be the KGB assassin that he's there to stop. So you can see the seeds of the idea are there in the Fleming story. But the script was written by Michael G. Wilson and Richard Maybaum while they didn't know who Bond was. So they sort of, it was sort of written as an in-between sort of Bond. But when Dalton came in at the last minute, they sort of adapted it slightly to suit his style. And Dalton himself insisted on changes because he wanted to take it back to more Fleming-esque Bond, a more gritty Bond. And you sort of see that in the movie. Mm-hmm. And the script itself, it took cues from a number of different things that were happening in the real world at the time. One of them being the rise of international arms brokers. Another one was the instability of the Soviet Union because of their entanglements in Afghanistan. And there was also a couple of major defections going on in the news at the time. A KGB officer defected to the UK. And there was also this guy called Vitaly Yuchenko who defected to the US. But while he was in the US being debriefed by the CIA, he was feeding them false information. And after he'd done that, he returned to the KGB. So very much like Koskov in the movie. Mm. And one of the things that the book, the film resurrected from the books is the anti-spy network Smersh, who had appeared in some of the earlier Bond books, but not so much later once Spectre came on the scene. But yeah, that's the story anyway.
Yeah. So the crew, we've got obviously John Glenn back again. Christmas 85, he was brought on board, and this is his fourth consecutive Bond film. And he said, "We constrict ourselves to the style we've created. If we did something too different or wrong, it would end the series. The Bond films tend to have a style which is unique, very fast, moving through a tremendous amount of scenes. We're always looking to film the impossible, and we feel we have to do that." So it's a trusted pair of hands, you know. He knows the game, he knows the formula, and this is something we see again where it pushes the boundaries after this, I would say, with License to Kill. But, you know, someone who knows it inside out and has been working on the franchise for many, many years. Cinematography, we've got Alec Mills, again, someone else who has worked on the franchise for a number of years. And he said, "I don't think people who go to the cinema realise how vital chemistry is on the floor. It's so important that there be chemistry between the director and the director of photography. John allows me to contribute rather than just be an illuminator. I can tell him my ideas and he'll say, 'It's bloody awful,' or 'Alec, I like it.' I had to hate to be on a film set where I had to sit there like a lemon." It's interesting because you see a lot of interviews around this film and the crew all talk about how much of a team they felt on this.
Yeah. Something. I think it's Joe Don Baker on the set on the audio commentary says the Bond films are like a family, and they every few years they host a family reunion, and then they just make a Bond film while they're doing it.
Yeah,
which I think is a lovely quote.
Yeah. So edited by John Grover and Peter Davis, we've got John Barry returning for the music as well. Peter Lamont, he also returns as the production designer. And Lamont, again, he talks about the team, and he said that he loved the thrill of being able to do what you can imagine. And he said people must never forget all these Bond pictures are a huge team effort. We're only as good as one another. It's all a big team. So yeah, I mean, that's something that they all talk about. And you know, a happy team generally leads to a decent film, doesn't it? You know,
absolutely.
We've seen how the opposite can affect, you know, an unhappy team has led to disasters on set. So yeah. We have John Richardson in the effects department, and Paul Weston is the stunt coordinator, with the stunt team being led by BJ Wirth and Remy Julien. So loads of familiar names in this one.
Yeah, BJ Wirth, obviously the skydiving expert, and then Remy Julien, the car, the driving expert there. But yeah, I saw Paul Weston doing a Q&A at the Prince Charles in the summer. He was just great value. It sounded like he was drafted in sort of last minute on this one, but sort of embraced it with both hands. So In terms of the returning cast, we've got Desmond Llewellyn is back as Q on his 13th appearance in the Bond series. He was a huge fan of Timothy Dalton, being a Welsh, fellow Welshman, of course. And this is where the relationship with Q sort of changes. There's a much more avuncular feel from Llewellyn being the legacy character. And Bond is sort of more understanding with him, and a bit more of the younger upstart here around the old department head.
Yeah, so we've got Robert Brown, and he's back in what is his third appearance as M, and Admiral Hargreaves. We've seen him in The Spy Who Loved Me. And at the beginning of the film, where Dalton is revealed, we see M's little office and the plane, the cargo plane. And he's got a nice relationship with Bond, I think, this time. Tell him to keep those personal feelings out of the mission. And obviously, moving forward, you know, that relationship escalates, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. I mean, in the next film, obviously, License to Kill, it really comes home, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I think. And we've talked about this idea of M's office being on the back of a plane being absolutely ridiculous. But yeah. It's a moment of pure Bond magic, I think. Yeah. We've got Geoffrey Keane as Frederick Grey, and he's got this. He's quite interesting in this. He has the scene where he talks about the PM having the guts for garters when they lose Koskov. And then also we've got another ally/enemy who bows out in this film, Brendan.
Yep. So Walter Gotell as General Gogol. You know, sometimes he's antagonist, sometimes ally, sometimes competitor, and sometimes they collaborate. So Pushkin is his replacement as the head of the KGB in this, but we do get a cameo at the end. As he goes to see Kara's concert with M.
Yes, and I think because Walter Gotell wasn't very well at the time, and they brought Pushkin in to do some of the more physical stuff, I guess. So you can sort of see where that is. So in terms of the new cast, we've got obviously we've talked about Timothy Dalton as Bond. But in terms of the Bond girls, we've got to reflect the sort of the growing AIDS epidemic in the real world. It's decided that Bond should be a one woman man in this movie. So we've got Mariam Diabo as Cara Malovi, Koskov's girlfriend and then later Bond's love interest. Diabo is a British actor. His mother's Georgian and her father was Anglo-Dutch, but she was raised in Paris and Geneva. And I think French is her first language. I think I understood. She had done a small amount of acting and had actually screen tested to play Pola Ivanova in A View to a Kill. But she'd been called in by Eon to do some screen tests with potential Bond actors. And she'd gone off to make a movie in Germany, which actually got cancelled, or they ran out of funding partway through. And the people behind the film sent what they'd filmed to United Artists to try and raise more money, put together a showreel and try and raise more money for the movie. That got the attention of United Artists, who then said maybe this could be the next Bond girl. And then Mariam Diabo bumped into Barbara Broccoli on a return to the UK, found they hadn't cast the role, and she got the part. One thing that she did regret about the movie, she said, though, was the Playboy shoot that she agreed to do for the promotion of the movie, which you just couldn't imagine them doing now, could you?
No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Other women in the movie, you've got Julie T. Wallace as Rizika Miklos. She's Bond's contact in Bratislava, working on the pipeline. She's a fantastic character, I think, in this. And she came to the producer's attention in a 1986 TV programme called The Lives and Loves of a She-Devil, which I haven't seen.
And that then finally... I just want to touch on that scene because it's brilliant. It's just fantastic, isn't it? You know, it's a nice comedic performance from her.
Yes.
Just brilliant.
It's a Roger Moore-esque moment, I think, in this movie. But I do think it's very funny. And then finally, you've got a lady called Belle Avery. She plays Linda, the woman on the yacht in Gibraltar. But surprisingly, I didn't know this before I was researching it, but she's also dubbed in the movie, and you can hear her original voice in the trailer. And I think perhaps it was changed because on the trailer, her voice is very English, but in the movie itself, it's more sort of continental, I think.
Right.
I think that's possibly why they changed it.
Still dubbing 25 years in.
I know, yeah.
It's all so boring here, Margot. If only I could find a real man.
But from a movie which hasn't got many Bond women, this you can't say the same about villains.
Absolutely. So, Joe Don Baker, he'd been seen by the Broccolis in a BBC series called Edge of Darkness in 1985. They loved his performance. They got him on board. He was cast as Brad Whittaker, who is a general of his own private army and also a collector of war memorabilia. But he says, when I first arrived in Tangier, I felt a bit like an outsider, but they're all very nice people. And Cubby Broccoli is the father of the family looking after his children. He said about the character that his job was to create the character and make him really dangerous but believable, and the trick to playing the villain is to sit back and think of all the awful things you could be. Let's just say the script might have let him down on that. I think he's much better when he returns in GoldenEye as a different character. Then we've got Jerome Crabbe. Is it Crabbe? Jerome Crabbe.
Yeah. Well, I was laughing about this because on the audio commentary, they call him Jerome Crabbe and everyone calls him Crabbe. Which, I mean, I'm not laughing at the pronunciation. I just think it's a funny name.
He was up for the role of Koskov, and he said he was called into a meeting at E.ON. He said, there, behind a table was Cubby, casting director Debbie McWilliams, Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson. It was like appearing in front of a jury. He went back to his agent's office and he said, you have the part. And he said he jumped in the air. He was so overwhelmed because he was such a huge Bond fan ever since they started making the films. He read the script. He thought Koskov was a wonderful role. And he asked John Glenn if he wanted the character to have a really strong Russian accent. And he said no. Very, very light accent, which is why we get the performance we do from him. But best of all, we get Andreas Wisniewski, who was an ex-ballet dancer, cast as Necros, who I believe is the only Bond villain we've had with his own soundtrack.
Yes, the Mr. Ben of Bond villains.
Yes, he can change his accent, he can deliver milk, explosive milk. and he loves listening to The Pretenders, doesn't he?
Who doesn't?
And somebody else was approached to play a small role as a henchman, Morten Harkett, the lead vocalist of A-ha.
Mm-hmm.
He declined because he had a lack of time, so he couldn't make that commitment, and also said that he felt they only wanted to cast him due to his popularity rather than his acting skills.
Which is quite bold of him, yeah. Really, or honest of him, really.
Mm, absolutely.
Didn't stop Madonna, did it?
Don't. So what about the Allies?
Well, we've got a lot here to go through as well. It's a strong movie for allies. You've got, as already mentioned, Pushkin, played by John Rhys-Davies. At the time, one of his biggest roles was Salah in Raiders of the Lost Ark. I love him in that movie. He'd also appeared in an Indiana Jones spoof called The King Solomon's Mines, which I haven't seen. But obviously best known nowadays is probably as Gimli in Lord of the Rings. He is was due to possibly return in both License to Kill and GoldenEye, but that didn't happen in the end. So he was dropped out of the drafts, unfortunately. That's John Rhys-Davies as Pushkin. Then we've got Art Malik as Cameron Shah, who I think is a great addition to this movie. He's mm-hmm. an Oxford-educated Mujahideen who Bond meets in the jail cell in Afghanistan. And then obviously teams up with him to foil the heroin operation. And he was a bit of a rising star at the time and had appeared in The Jewel and the Crown on TV and also the film A Passage to India. And obviously this was his big audition for True Lies, which would follow in a few years' time and he would get a much bigger role. But any similarities to a certain Osama bin Laden are purely coincidental.
We have Thomas Wheatley, not that one, as Saunders. He is head of Section V, which is the Vienna base, and he's in charge of handling Koskov's defection at the start, and makes that well known to Bond, doesn't he?
This is my operation.
Yeah. But the actor was a stage actor at this point, and his biggest screen role before that was as a registrar on TV in The Singing Detective.
I believe he'd also had some dealings with the Secret Service himself in his personal or his career at this point, because I know that they mention it. John Glenn mentions it on the audio commentary.
He
had a sort of an inside information there.
So he had more right than most to play this role. Obviously, the relationship with him and Bond in this is wonderful. And as it grows throughout the film, when they first start out, there's a dislike. Saunders feels like Bond's getting in on his patch. But obviously, Bond's brought in for a reason, isn't he? You know, because he's the man that can kill. And throughout the film, their relationship, it blossoms. And it's actually one of my favourite relationships with an ally in the franchise, I think.
Yeah, 100%.
There's a deleted scene with Saunders as well, where the exploding door cut Saunders in half at the fair, and there's a deleted Bond quip about the Saunders needing two stretchers to take him away.
Better make
that two,
wouldn't it? Yeah, it would be quite a cruel moment for this touching relationship that had blossomed, and then him making a quip.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it was the right thing to do to get rid of that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've touched on Judy T. Wallace. Have we got anyone else? Any other allies?
Well, obviously we've got Felix Leiter. How could you forget Felix Leiter's in this movie?
Because it's John Terry.
It's John Terry. Yes, it's probably the most instantly forgettable Felix Leiter of the whole series. I mean, we did a whole episode on Felix Leiter, and even I can't remember much about him. But played by John Terry from Hawk the Slayer, and obviously made such a big impression. They swapped him for David Hedderton in the very next movie, Live and Let Die. So there's that. But finally, Miss Moneypenny, worth mentioning here, because we've got a whole new Miss Moneypenny here in the shape of Caroline Bliss. Again, we did a whole episode on Moneypenny, so go back there if you want to learn more about Caroline Bliss. But I think she's interesting in this. She was only 26 when she took this role. She has that whole sort of come to my house and listen to Barry Manilow collection thing, which is, a little bit cringy, but quite sweet in a way.
It dates the film though. That's what I was saying.
It does date the film, yeah. And there's also that awful sort of sound effect of Bond tapping her on the bum as well, which...
awful. Doesn't need to be in there.
Yeah. Don't think you'll get away with that nowadays. No. But that's it. Yes, Caroline Bliss. So let's dive into production. And the first place they go to is Gibraltar, and the principal photography begins there in September. And it's 17 days before Timothy Dalton is even able to join them to shoot. So they start cracking with some of the second unit stuff. And as mentioned before, BJ Worth led the skydiving team with Jake Lombard to do the jump onto Gibraltar. They jumped out of the plane, the Hercules. That wasn't the problem for them. They said it was landing in what BJ Worth described as extremely hazardous locations. And when you watch it in the movie, you can see what they mean. It's like the place is littered with trees and lampposts and telegraph poles and all that sort of stuff. So it is quite incredible, really. They did look at using cranes to lower people down, but they just felt like the results wouldn't be good enough. So they did it for real. And they actually managed to shoot all the landings of all three 00 agents all in one day, amazingly. But that stuff really, really works. It looks incredible when you see it in the movie. One of the parts that caused some issues was the landing of the Land Rover that gets shot off the cliff. They took one out to the Mojave Desert and dropped it out of a helicopter to see what would happen. But unfortunately, the parachutes got wrapped up in the car and it just landed on the desert floor and it was flat as a pancake. It was ridiculous. So they went to plan B, which was to launch the Land Rover off Beachy Head with an air cannon. And they used a remote control parachute to launch the dummy out of the back of it and then exploded the car midair. And that's what you see in the film. And it's quite an incredible use of miniatures and models and practical effects on that. So Dalton finished shooting Brenda Starr in America on the Saturday, flew to England on the Sunday and started shooting Bond on the Monday and flew out to join second unit in Gibraltar a few days later after shooting his first scenes at Pinewood. And there he earned his reputation for being someone to throw himself into the stunt work.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So he shot the scene on top of the Jeep for real, despite Cubby's best warnings not to damage his leading man just as he starts work. But Paul Weston, the stunt coordinator, he really praised Dalton's bravery and courage for doing it. And it shows in the movie that that car is moving fast. They are steep drops. So I really think, you know, Dalton's really putting Roger Moore to shame there, you know.
Especially from the stunts, the stark contrast in stunts in View to a Kill, where it's blindingly obvious.
So the opening, the exercise was filmed mostly on the Upper Rock in Gibraltar, and there's a little bit of trivia there. About the aircraft. It was marked as a Royal Air Force aircraft, but the Hercules that they used was actually a Spanish Air Force plane. And then they actually reused that plane later in the Afghanistan sequences, but this time with Russian markings.
So off to Austria, and in October 1986, they got there, and this doubled for Czechoslovakia in the film. So heavily leaned on Austria for that. The first unit started shooting with Andreas Wisniewski and the stuntman Paul Weston. And during the course of 3 days it took them to film their fight, Weston actually fractured a finger and Wisniewski knocked him out. So very full on throwing themselves into that. The Bratislavan sequences, they were shot in Vienna. The outside shots of the concert hall, the Volskopa one, and the interior were shot at Sofian Sale. So really using Vienna here,
it really shows. I think it really, brings a real sort of Euro thriller vibe to the movie.
Yeah, something that we'd later see in Bourne, the Bourne film.
Absolutely.
So the tram scene, that was shot in Varung in Vienna. And the border chase, that was filmed in Carinthia, which is in Austria also. And then we see the finale of the film at Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna. So the amusement park, Prater Amusement Park, which is in Austria. And that's where one of the deleted scenes with Saunders was shot as well. And also where we see Saunders' demise at the fair with the balloons.
And yeah, John Glenn talks about that being a tribute to The Third Man, the Carol Reed film, because it was one of his favourites. I think he'd worked on it, in fact. It was one of his first films that he'd worked on.
Yeah, it's a nice nod.
So he wanted it to, yeah, a little homage to that. I know that's sort of a big part of The Third Man, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, now, big return here in Living Daylights. Another one of those sort of key elements that makes it feel like a classic Bond film is the Aston Martin returns in this movie. So it's the first time a new Aston Martin has appeared in a Bond movie since On Her Majesty's Secret Service. A big gap. And obviously, I think the company, Aston Martin, was by all accounts sort of very eager to renew their association with the series. Cubby and Michael Wilson took the new Aston Martin V8 Vantage Volante for a drive, and there and then agreed that they wanted it in the movie. So Aston Martin actually had a 2-year waiting list for the car, but the producers requested that they make it ready in 6 weeks.
Anything for Cubby?
Anything for Cubby. Pete Lamont said that they provided many hardtop Volantes, but the rush was such that the open top version was actually borrowed from Victor Gauntlet, who was the boss of Aston Martin at the time, and rushed out to Vienna for them.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy, really.
Yeah.
Which is something that I think happens again on Spy Love Me. We'll speak about that in a few weeks. But yeah, I mean, I love this car. It's obviously tricked out with all the gadgets as well. I think for me, it's probably the third most iconic Bond car, behind the DB5, behind the Lotus Esprit. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I really like the laser, where it saws the top of the car off the other car.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got the cello stunt. Now, those scenes, like I said, were shot in Bratislava primarily. That's where Bond picks up Cara. And then they have that argument about the cello, the Stradivarius. Another nice comedic moment. I think he plays that well.
Lovely, yeah.
He loses the argument and they go and get it. The Czech police and the KGB, they chase Bond. And this is where we see the gadgets that are in the Aston Martin while they're on the way to the border. So the skis, the rocket booster, missiles, and obviously those laser hubcaps, which are one of my favourites, I think. And then a self-destruct system as well, which they use when they jump into the cello case instead. So at the end of the sequence, John Glenn came up with the cello case toboggan stunt, and he had to demonstrate that it would work physically before Cubby approved it. So when filming came, it took 3 days to shoot, and Marion Darbo found it particularly stressful. She said there that they had placed little explosives under the snow, so it looked like they were shooting at us. I have a phobia of big bangs, guns and explosions. So she wore a Walkman to block out the sounds of the desert finale, but unfortunately was unable to do it for this bit.
I mean, it's a silly action sequence, isn't it? But yeah. it's sort of just about gets away with it. I believe Timothy Dalton threw the cello himself in that final bit where he throws it over the thing. We have nothing to declare but this cello. It's a silly old moment, isn't it?
It is. But it's created wonderfully by somebody in Lego form, isn't it? Online.
Oh, YouTube. Yes. Yeah, that is great.
That's well worth a look.
Yeah. So to Morocco, the shoot moved to Morocco in October 86 to shoot the scenes set in Tangier, which also, and scenes in Morocco also doubled for Afghanistan. And the Afghan castle is actually a fortress in the centre of Morocco. It's in the Kasbah of Tamdacht, in the eastern edges of the High Atlas. And the town close by is called Ouarzazate, and they call it Hollywood, the locals do, because it's a home to many, many film shoots, including Lawrence of Arabia and Gladiator. So the villa of Brad Whitaker is actually a place called the Forbes Museum at the time, which was in Palace El Mendoub in Tangier. Obviously, for the exterior and the interiors were recreated in Pinewood, but at the time it was being used as a model as a museum that had a collection of toy soldiers. So they took that idea and put it in the movie, which I thought was quite amazing. And one other amazing thing they shot in Morocco that didn't make it into the movie was this infamous flying carpet deleted scene, which was a John Glenn devised moment. Have you seen this, Brendan?
I have.
Yeah. So you see, while Bond's sort of escaping in Tangier, he takes a magic carpet ride, which involves taking a carpet and draping it over some wires between buildings and then sliding down it. And there's even a couple of natives looking on incredulously as it slides past, and they're smoking a shisha pipe, saying, "I told you this stuff was good when it goes past." It is absolutely rubbish. It's so slow. Even John Glenn at the time said it just didn't work. It just, like, the carpet doesn't look real. It went too slowly. So yeah, luckily that was axed.
Yeah, it's something I can imagine Roger Moore doing.
Again, yeah, probably would have been fine with him.
So the air stunt that at the end of the film. Like you said before, the aircraft belonged to the Spanish Air Force. So during this, we have a fight that breaks out on the open ramp of the aircraft while it's in flight between Bond and Necros, leading to Necros falling to his death. Now, BJ Worth and his colleague Lombard, what's Lombard's first name, do you know?
Jake
Lombard. They double for Bond and Necros in those scenes where they're hanging and fighting on the bag in the plane's open cargo door. So the exterior shots filmed over the Mojave Desert. And Peter Lamont said about this air stunt, "I suppose our biggest chore was to build a complete Hercules interior with an executive cabin that had removable bulkheads. We built the cockpit, the whole cargo bay, and the exterior around the cargo bay. The cargo door worked. We also built the exterior of the flight deck. We built the whole thing on C-stage on an all-way rocker." He said it looked quite good, and they cut it in with the work that the aerial unit did. He said, "To the credit of the editors and the director, I defy anybody to say actually how we did it, what kind of process we used. I will say this, it was done reel for reel, in the studio and in the air."
And yeah, and it's a stunning set piece.
It's absolutely fantastic. You know, the way they fused it together is great. But remember those stunt guys, they're actually up there and on those long shots. And that's amazing, isn't it? And then to splice it with the stuff that they shot at Pinewood and really make
interiors of the plane looks real to me.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? Especially with the way that they've shot it out, with the view outside of the plane, you totally buy that they're thousands of feet in the air. Yeah.
Mm. So then to Pinewood in December 86, you've got a bunch of stuff that's shot there. Q's workshop, apparently they had 12, the video screen was screens provided by Philips. One of the things that happened there while they were shooting at Pinewood was the Prince and Princess of Wales visited the 007 stage to watch filming being done. And Caroline Bliss had actually played Diana in a film not long before that, so it must have been a bit weird.
Wow.
But Jerome Crabbe, while they were there, suggested that Diana should break one of the prop bottles over Prince Charles' heads, and the photo made headlines around the world. You could not buy that kind of publicity. Mm-hmm. You can just watch Jerome Crabbe while it's happening, and he's just laughing his head off between the two of them. It's absolutely brilliant. And then, as mentioned, we had the Land Rover that was shot at Beachy Head itself. And then there were some other locations across the UK as well.
Yep, so they used the south side of Trafalgar Square for the new Universal Exports building. That's where Q's workshop is located. Necros, where he strangles the milkman at White Pond Farm in Henley-on-Thames. And the exterior of Stoner House in Oxfordshire, that doubles as a safe house that gets absolutely destroyed when they go and pick up Koskov. Then we've got the fight between Necros and MI6 agent. That was shot at Pinewood. And then, of course, we've also got that final air stunt was at Pinewood as well.
Yeah, and all the interiors as well, I guess, like the tents, yes, in Afghanistan and the prison and all that sort of stuff was there as well.
Yeah. And then filming wraps February 1987.
Yeah, so 3 months there at Pinewood.
Mm.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
So let's talk about the music. This was John Barry, his final Bond score. He returned for his 11th and final James Bond score, and he was fresh on the job from winning his fourth Oscar for Born Free. He had been working at this point on a film, The Golden Child, the Eddie Murphy movie, which I've been listening to on YouTube, actually, because it turns out the John Barry score for The Golden Child actually was not used in the movie. It was abandoned in favour of a much more 80s sounding score. But you can listen to it, and some people say it's like Barry's lost Bond score, and you could imagine it. It's well worth checking out. But Barry included lots of cello pieces for Mariam Diabo's character to play, because she's a cello player, and so Mariam took a month's worth of cello lessons in order to look like she could play it for herself. And famously, John Barry also cameos in the film conducting an orchestra. Talking about it later, John Glenn said it was very unusual for John. Unlike a lot of other people who like to appear in movies, John had never asked before, but on that film he asked if he could appear. At the time, it struck me as a bit strange. It was almost a premonition that this was going to be his last Bond. I was happy to accommodate him, and he was eminently qualified to do so. Mariam Diabo talked about socialising a lot with John Barry while they were shooting in London. And then for the score itself, he wrote 57 minutes of music for the film in just 4 weeks. And actually, it's quite significant, this movie, is that there's a lot of synthesizer-driven rhythm tracks within it. That's the first for a Bond film. Barry worked with an engineer producer called Paul Staveley O'Duffy, who actually received a co-producing credit on the film with Barry, and he helped a lot with the synthesizer stuff. And he sort of just felt it brought a lot of energy and impact to the score, and I think it really does. It was recorded in May 1987 with an orchestra of 70, and it would be, like I said, John Barry's final Bond score. In an interview, he said, "I'm not going to go through this again. That was the end of it." In another interview, he said, "It's lost its natural energy. It just started to be just formula. And once that happens, the work gets really hard. The spontaneity and excitement of the original scores is gone. So you move on." And he said goodbye in a classic John Barry style, complete class and distinction. He took out a full page advert in Variety to salute quarter century of Bond in the cinema. He said, "Congratulations, Cubby. It's been a great 25 years. Your friend, John Barry." So signing off in style. But I think one of the reasons why he wanted to leave at this point was to do with one of the songs that he wrote, co-wrote for the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, he had problems with the previous film as well, with Duran Duran. If you remember, they didn't work that well together. So in this one, The Living Daylights, it's co-written by Pal Vakhtar of A-ha. and they also recorded it. And John Glenn said that Barbara Broccoli was really in touch with the current music scene, and so was Cubby Broccoli, funnily enough. Barbara came up with the idea of a-ha, and she dragged us to see them at some venue in Croydon. There were all these 15-year-old girls screaming. The kids loved them. Something they've always carried on. I think Barbara's always picking the latest pop sensation, right up to No Time to Die. So, in terms of writing and collaborating, it didn't work out. And Paul Factor said, we're in the middle of doing our second album, so we were busy doing other stuff. And we had different working methods, so we came across a little too efficient. We were like, okay, we've just got to get this done. And we didn't want to cancel a show to go to the premiere. So there were certain things like that that rubbed him the wrong way. So he handed them a version of the song, and they felt there was a note that was wrong in the string arrangements. And so they fixed it. And obviously John Barry wasn't a fan of that. You know, they've just gone in and butchered his work in his eyes. But he later on, he does admit, he said, I do think he did a great job. It was a fantastic string score. We just had one chord in the middle that was important to us. That was changed and stuff like that happens. Maybe I've dulled over the years. But he praises what John Barry did with the song, basically, now. So there's two different versions that are very minimal in difference. And so you hear John Barry's version on the official soundtrack and then a-ha's version in one of a-ha's compilation albums, Headlines
right.
and Deadlines. So, yeah, like I said, you know, they've looked back and seen that he was, you know, he knew what he was doing, didn't he, John Barry?
Yeah.
So, yeah, but there were more songs in this one. So we had songs over the opening, obviously, but also at the end. So at the end of the film, we have If There Was a Man, which was also the love film of the theme of the film that goes throughout the score. And it was one of the songs, one of the two songs for the film that was by Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders, who John Barry did enjoy working with. So there was a positive story in this as well. But the other song, Where Has Everybody Gone? That's Necros's unofficial theme that he listens to on his Walkman, which they use every time when Necros attacks. And there's also the instrumental that is part of the soundtrack, especially when they play, when Necros and Agent Green have a fight at the safe house. And again, when they Bond and Necros fight on the cargo plane. And the Pretenders were originally considered to perform the title song. So had that have happened, who knows, maybe we would have got another John Barry.
Who knows? So the titles, Morris Binder's back doing his titles, obviously would be his penultimate one. You've got the naked women wearing aviator sunglasses, very Top Gun reminiscent with the film coming out a year after the Tom Cruise film. You've got obviously the standard sort of silhouettes of women being carried off by Bond. You've got laser projected 007 logos. You've got smoke and water motif. It's, to be honest, I think Binder's phoning in a little bit on this one.
Yeah.
But according to his editor, Peter Davies, Binder had spent as long making the titles on the film as they did actually making the film itself. And then there was like a children's paddling pool full of water was used to make the rippling effects. But yeah, and one small thing to note, you've got optical cameraman Alan Church. His hands are in the film. He's the guy's, it's his hand that fires the gun in the first shot. Because Morris Binder noticed he had very small hands. So that was him being used in that. So we've got posters, and I think this one has to be the last great of the classic style Bond posters. In fact, it's the very last of the hand-painted Bond posters. The main quad was painted by Brian Bysouth. It's got Bond in his tuxedo in the middle of a gun barrel pointing the gun, and it's surrounded by glimpses of a lot of the action set pieces like the Aston Martin, the bridge explosion, the horse riding, the parachuting, all that sort of stuff. It's just one of the all-time great movie, not just Bond posters, but movie posters, I think. And there were a few other teasers to mention. You've got that interesting one, which is a US Advance teaser, which has the grill of the DB5 with the 007 license plate. Obviously quite interesting because the DB5's not in it.
Yeah.
And then you've got the quad teaser with Dalton and his gun and the tagline, James Bond 007 at his most dangerous. And that was something they really hammered home in the movie. This was a new, harder-edged Bond. And then you've also got the one where you've got Dalton in a blue gun barrel with a silhouetted woman holding a pistol with a silencer at her side. And that's more sort of a classic sort of style Bond, almost like Few Eyes Only influenced one there.
So with this one, we've got something a bit different because we've got a leak of the work print of the film. In 1987 in April, it got out and there was a version of the film that was going around. And includes an alternative gun barrel. And I implore you to seek this out because Dalton walks in and jumps and shoots. It's strange. It's a strange gun barrel. It had an extended briefing scene with M. And the Q branch, we also get a sequence where there's a quill pen. A ceremonial quill pen that transmits what it writes, which I think is something that exists now, isn't it? Like, isn't the Apple Pen? Apple Pen.
Yeah,
do
I think
that.
It probably does. Yeah.
But this was considered a major security breach, with the co-editors were under suspicion to have leaked this, but. It transpired that the post-production facility that was in charge of protecting the data, they'd been really lax with the security, so somehow it had gone out. But it's not something we've seen before or since, is it, I don't think, a leak?
No, not that I can think of. Obviously, the closest we came to was Spectre, the script leaking, but I don't recall the movie being leaked itself. So let's talk about the premiere. So the film's obviously came out in the Silver Jubilee of the franchise, and the film on the 29th of June 1987, the world royal premiere happened at Odeon Leicester Square. Prince and Princess of Wales were there, and Leicester Square was renamed James Bond Square for the day. Street sign was changed, everything, and obviously a huge poster up in there. And then there was the V8 Volante was outside, and then Dalton's stunt double Simon Crane abseiled down the building dressed as Bond before on the TV special he actually became Bond, so it was made to look like Dalton had parachuted down. And Desmond Llewellyn was there as well in Leicester Square, and he demonstrated the car to Charles and Diana, apparently. Yes. So what about the reviews?
So the press had seen the film that morning, and the reviews were generally positive, and they're quite enthusiastic about this return to a slightly more serious tone. In Time Out, Brian Case said, "This is the best Bond in years." And Pauline McLeod said, "It's a terrific roller coaster of fun and excitement." That was in the Daily Mirror. And then Raymond Dergner in the BFI's monthly film bulletin said, "The film is essentially an action circus." Douglas Fairbanks' swashbuckle update by secret agent costume and sex with everything. But he also noted that the series was starting to look slightly dated next to Indiana Jones. Starburst magazine, Gary Russell, he said it was one of the very best Bond films. And He said that Dalton was actually one of the best of the four Bond actors to date. And he said The Living Daylights has paved the way for a further 25 years of good James Bond films. And that is largely due to Timothy Dalton, who deserves as much credit as possible.
Yeah, it looks like the Daily Telegraph was quite keen on Dalton as well. They called him kind of more human, charming and low profile Bond. But Alexander Walker of the Evening Standard said Cubby, Broccoli and his associates to start the think tank going for the film after this and decide what kind of Bond they want. For at the moment, they haven't got one. Ooh. Mm. In terms of, I mean, in retrospect reviews, it's gone up a bit in the rankings. Mm. It's, you know, it sort of seems to have gained a better reputation since then. But the release, it was a limited release from 30th of June, starting on 18 screens and expanding to 131 screens by its fourth week. And it topped the UK chart throughout July and August, and it was toppled 6 weeks later by Lethal Weapon. It grossed 8.2 million in the UK. And took $191.2 million total in globally. So it opened in the US 31st of July and was the box office was a bit of an uptick from the Roger Moore era. 40 million more than A View to a Kill. And yeah, so it was pretty big. Did it win any awards?
It did. It won Best Sound Editing from the Motion Picture Sound Editors Guild of America in 1988. And that was due to the authentic sound effects of the skirmish at the end, which was recorded in a separate studio and dubbed over it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So at this point, as we always do, we look at our three-word reviews from our listeners and our followers on Twitter. We put these out and you reply with your replies, your three-word reviews. Interestingly, we got a response this week from Don Mancini, the creator of the Child's Play movies.
Ah.
So thanks for listening, Don. He said The Lady Rose, which is less of a review, more of a inventory, yeah. But we'll take it. our friends at MI6 HQ, they said parachuted in literally. Obviously, that's a reference to Dalton. Gary Hamilton went for more to the point. Bloody excellent film. Gig Goer said absolutely superb Bond. Stackabo, top-notch Bond. Gareth J. Lewis, he agrees with us, keeps getting better. So this is one that, we both agree with that on. Scott Wagner says moves engaging, exciting, which I think is quite good. And the first run says best 80s Bond. Where do you stand on that, Brendan?
Best 80s Bond. Well,
yeah,
I would have said, you know, a year ago that would have been License to Kill. But like we keep saying, the more I see this film, the more I really enjoy it. And you know, bloody excellent movie is, it's definitely one I agree with as well. It's tough between those two. I think at the moment this one slightly edges it. What about you?
Well, I'm still a huge fan of License to Kill. I think it's the more pure of the two films. I think there's not much between them, but I do really love the exoticism of License to Kill over the sort of the sort of the Euro vibe of this one. So I think for that reason, I think that License to Kill still sort of edges it for me. Just going to throw in a couple more three-word reviews here before we wrap up. Cool Zombie, on the flip side, said bloody awful film. So
wow,
there you go. Sally Hughes, though, this is probably my favourite. Dalton is delicious.
Isn't he just?
Yes. Isn't he just? And then Christopher Zabelli, Dalton, Timothy Dalton. I mean, let's start with Dalton, I guess. I mean, in terms of like the film's legacy and reputation now, Dalton, I think, is agreed by most hardcore fans to be up there as the best of the Bonds, right?
I would say so, yeah. And I think wider on, you know, an audience that is wider than just maybe just Bond fans, he is quite forgotten, I would say.
Mm.
And it's very unjust. Because you give him your time, he proves to be an excellent Bond.
Yeah, I think just general lack of visibility. There's only two films in his canon in the series, and so if you're gonna switch on ITV2, if you're gonna switch on a Bond film, the odds are stacked against Dalton. Unfortunately, it's more likely to be a Roger. It's then more likely to be a Sean Connery film. And then actually, most likely, it's going to be Skyfall on ITV2 because they show that every week by the looks of it. So Dalton, unfortunately, just doesn't get the look in. But I think now with the sort of the Daniel Craig era, I think the Dalton films are getting more reappraised. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will spread out to the general public as well. And they'll sort of recognise him.
Because, you know, without Dalton's portrayal, who knows, we would never have got the Daniel Craig films and the way that he portrayed it, because, you know, he laid the groundwork, didn't he?
Yeah, I can't remember who said it. Someone much cleverer than me, but they said Timothy Dalton ran so Daniel Craig could walk.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite funny. Yeah. But also, anecdotally speaking as well, I think Dalton is very popular with female audiences as well, because he is much more dashing, perhaps, than the other... you know, he's more of a Heathcliff type, isn't he?
And yeah.
Obviously, famously played Heathcliff as well. Just a shame we didn't get any more movies from him.
No, there is, but you know, there's got that great book by Mark Edlitz. So we can at least see where it could have gone.
If you haven't read that one, by the way, Mark Edlitz's book, I can't remember what it's called, The Many Adventures or Many Lives of James Bond. It details what Dalton's third and fourth movie would have been like. So well worth checking out. So just to say a couple of thank yous before we wrap up. Thank you very much to Mark Harrison, who was hopefully meant to be here, but wasn't able to, but shared his notes nonetheless. And also Neil Alcock, who we are meant to record this episode with, and we suffered some more technical issues. So thank you both for contributing to this. But it was just me and you in the end.
It was, yeah. And if you listen to this, finally it managed to get recorded and it's out there somehow.
Yes, somehow. But if people want to get in touch with the show, Brendan, how do they find us on social media?
At James Bond A to Z on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
And if you want to email the show, you can email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk. Please do. We always love receiving your emails. If you haven't emailed us before, then I generally reply with an offer of a podcast sticker. They are still very much available. So if you want to email the show with anything, then feel free to do so. So on that note, just remains for me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week with The Man with the Golden Gun.
Ciao.
James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
You'd better hurry. M wants you to stop at Harrods on your way and pick up a parcel.
Moneypenny, be a dear. Ask records to monitor check publication and news services for me. See if they can find any mention of a woman cellist at the Conservatoire in Bratislava.
I didn't know you were such a music lover, James. Anytime you want to drop by and listen to my Barry Manilow collection.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.